Welcome to EB5 Investment Voice, where attorney insights intersects with immigration investments. If you are a foreign investor, domestic fund manager, or enterprising entrepreneur and want to get the most out of the EB5 program, you have come to the right place. I'm Mark Deal, and I'll be your co-host on this journey. I'm joined by your host, Mona Shaw, and other attorneys at Mona Shaw & Associates, as well as immigration leaders from around the world. So let's get into EB5 Investment Voice.
You know, Mark and Rebecca, we've discussed this many times on our shows over the years, but I really don't feel that it's brought out enough that EB5 is quite unlike other immigration. So if I give you an example, if somebody has an application for a pending visa and that gets denied, that affects that particular person. EB5 is different because a denial or a delay in adjudication or anything of the above cannot just affect multiple people, multiple investors, but it can affect complete communities within the EB5 project.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more, Mona. I mean, it's not just infecting one investor, it's infecting many investors within a project, but the project is also there for the communities, and it's affecting those that need economic impact. For example, we've seen projects that help, for instance, the disabled community. It's not impacting just economic, but helping those who need it.
Right. And what we often find, Mark, is that denials, adjudication delays, not only do they have a wide-ranging impact, but it's often caused by just confusion. Many a times, all we need to do is communicate with USCIS, who I swear, I think they just live in a bubble. You know, they're not part of the real world at times.
Right. Luckily for us, we have EB5 Investment Voice. This podcast has been going for nearly 7 years now. But it's not just us that need that voice. EB5 projects themselves also need the voice because they impact and drive and steer the industry.
Right. Well, we have had an opportunity opened out. That was through the Behring case. And we have a guest on our show today who is going to discuss all of that with us. Aaron, welcome back.
Thank you very much, Mona. Appreciate being here.
Yeah, welcome back to the show, Aaron. For those that haven't heard Aaron's voice before on EB5 Investment Voice, Aaron is the Executive Director of Invest in the USA, which is the organization focused on stimulating the U.S. economy for the benefit of American workers, American communities, and all those invested in sustainable domestic job creation, specifically through the EB5 program. Aaron, welcome back.
Thank you very much. It's always a pleasure to be here.
Aaron, the Behring settlement, we discussed this, we wrote about this at great length, but now we are starting to see some practicalities. Please tell our audience about the settlement process, first of all, and how IIUSA were involved.
Well, the settlement process was probably not unlike settlement negotiations in any legal matter. I mean, you had on the one side, obviously, USCIS, represented by the Department of Justice, and on the other side, a handful of plaintiffs, not only the five plaintiffs that were regional centers, members of IUSA as well as IUSA, but also Colin Behring and the Behring Regional Center. And it was simply a question of coordinating everything from time and logistics to opinions, demands, and requirements, perceived or otherwise. But at the end of the day, you know, the conversations filtered out. I'd have to actually say that everybody played pretty well together. IIUSA is a trade association that has members who are, at the end of the day, all rowing in the same direction insofar as policy, but they're competitors. And you know what I mean? That's the nature of an association. And so even in this settlement conversation, we had organizations that were competitors. But I have to say that everybody, you know, the Behring Regional Center, all the way down to IIUSA, I think everybody had their eye on the prize and was able to come to a very impactful solution at the end of the day. And I believe, honestly, that USCIS feels the same. I'm very optimistic about their outlook.
Well, just in case any of our listeners have forgotten about the Behring case, this was the case which is allowing existing regional centers to go back into business. And one of the really interesting points of settlement was the fact that there is now going to be some kind of communication between regional centers and USCIS moving forward. Isn't that correct, Aaron?
That is correct. It was something that the plaintiffs, and I'll give credit where credit is due, Ron Klasko, who was counsel for the five regional centers and IAUSA, suggested that we include in a proposed settlement agreement, because why not? And everybody thought, yeah, that's a great idea, not really knowing what would come of it. And then CIS agreed, which I think is another indication that, you know, the agency understands that there is a need to engage. And so, yeah, that was a huge part, a huge and very pleasant and welcome surprise as part of the settlement agreement. The legal issue itself was resolved. Honestly, that would have been enough. Regional centers, you know, that were part of the pre-RIA no longer had to deconstruct and reconstruct under a new authorization under the new RIA. That was phenomenal. But then this added bonus of communication with CIS once a quarter for 2 years was really, really quite a pleasant surprise.
I agree with you, Aaron, because we were all expecting maybe just a decision or maybe just in, you know, stakeholder engagements, which we have seen as well. But the fact that we could go out there and we can speak with them one-on-one, tell them our issues and what's happening, I think that's very important. But
Rebecca, it isn't one-on-one. This is something I really want to ask you, Aaron. Is this fair? Because from my understanding, it's only the people who were part of the settlement negotiation. It doesn't mean everybody in the industry. Unless you think something else, Rebecca.
I was hoping that with IAUSA being part of their communications, and then Ron Klasko, I know he's representing the regional centers, but he should be representing, are we representing the industry as a whole?
Mr. Klasko is representing IAUSA. We do have an agreement in place with him. He is our counsel, so he does represent us. Interestingly, though, I don't know that it necessarily, at least in the context of the agreement that we have with counsel, that it means that Klasko is representing everybody in the EB5 industry, nor does it necessarily legally mean that he's representing each of the members of IAUSA. He is representing IAUSA. And I think it might actually be too early to say how that is going to play itself out. I think we can rest assured that IAUSA has its members' best interests in mind. And to that extent, you know, IAUSA's leadership has developed working groups that are focused on topics of conversation for these meetings with CIS that we then present to the balance of the plaintiffs so that it can be included. So there is a mechanism for pushing issues up to the top and onto that table. Yeah, but Klasko represents IAUSA, doesn't represent all the members of IAUSA.
Oh, I see. But Aaron, are you feeling that USCIS actually understand that projects need a voice? Because for years now, we have been requesting separate what's called G28, which is the form which shows representation for projects. So we often represent projects and projects only. And we don't have a voice. If something goes wrong, it goes to the attorney who's doing the source of funds. RFEs go there, and it just doesn't come to us because we're not given a voice.
So the difference is that these quarterly stakeholder meetings are about RIA, the EB5 regulations that came in March. They're about regional centers. And I think what we are trying to say is that the projects themselves, right, the ones that are out there making a difference in these communities, they're the ones who actually need representation, right? They're the ones who, if something goes wrong, who do they turn to, right? The investors have the attorneys because we're filing on behalf of the investor, but who can the projects actually reach out to? Is there a different body? Who is listening to what's happening with the projects?
Well, that's a much more succinct way of putting what I've just said in, Rebecca. Yeah. Aaron, we've given you a lot of time to think about this.
Wow. Well, I appreciate the time. I think I might need a few more hours. I don't really have an answer for you. You know, I think I can definitely say that the forum that the settlement agreement established is not the forum for issues to be raised on a case-by-case basis with regards to projects.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's the whole point. You know, we're talking generalities. And again, if it's something which is like an industry-related thing or it's a specific, how do we get to speak? There really doesn't seem to be anything out there. Rebecca, has there been anything else in the past that we've, you know, projects could use?
Well, remember a long time ago, Mona, and this was project specific, where you went and you had a discussion with an economist from USCIS regarding one of the projects.
Yes, we went down to USCIS's office to have that.
Yeah, yeah, and that was a way that I thought, look, at the end of the day, this is a business. And is USCIS capable of handling this, right? We've had many discussions in the past that we believe that the Chamber of Commerce or someone else should have oversight over these projects.
Agreed.
Who has an understanding, right? And I thought it was great that you were able to go down, speak to the economists to clarify, you know, if you can't get it out in an RFE and a response, it's great that a project can go down there, have representation from the attorney, and discuss what this project is all about. I haven't seen anything since then. And yeah, that was what, 2014, 2013? It was a long time ago.
It was. Aaron, was any of that kind of, anything of that nature brought up in the settlement? I mean, allowing, again, you're saying it's going to be no, it's, this is just specific areas and nothing, no project specific issue, right?
Keep in mind why the lawsuit was filed. You know, the lawsuit was filed because CIS interpreted the RIA as requiring pre-enactment regional centers to have to close their doors and then start from scratch. In other words, redesignate from scratch. That was how the government was interpreting the RIA. Yeah. The plaintiffs and everybody, quite frankly, saw that as completely erroneous, and the court agreed with us. The court felt that there was what the court determined to be legal error in the interpretation. So that was why the lawsuit was filed. It's a very finite argument. It's a very finite issue. That's why the lawsuit was filed. That was really the big win at the end of the day. Mm-hmm. And then in addition to that, as we started off by saying, you know, the court said, and thou shalt have quarterly meetings for 2 years to be sure that the law is being continued to be interpreted and implemented correctly. That's what is begging a lot of the interesting questions and what will be discussed in those quarterly meetings. And unfortunately, issues around project hiccups was not part of the original lawsuit, and I think probably would exist in the old era as well as the new. So it definitely was not brought up, unfortunately.
You know, this brought up quarterly meetings because we've had leadership discussions on this, that these are quarterly meetings with USCIS. But how much can we bring into these meetings, right? Is it limited to just RIA, or is it a way to open up and talk to USCIS about issues that are happening, right? We've seen so many other issues as well with, you know, RFEs and denials that are happening, and even I-29s with investors having issues with getting their fingerprints done. Is this just limited to RIA? And is that what we're going to keep that to? Or is this a discussion with USCIS to see where they can help us in other areas within the EB-5 program?
But the answer is, I don't know. But if I was to bet, I would say that we do have the opportunity to expand the conversation if the conversation goes well at the outset. We've had one meeting so far, just one.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, you know, I think both sides were sort of coming to the table being a little wet behind the ears in this process without knowing exactly how to engage or what to expect or what the court may be expecting us to do or say or come out with. So there weren't really a lot of outcomes of that initial meeting other than the fact that the meeting itself happened, which was a great thing. I am of the personal opinion, and I don't want to be labeled as putting this in other people's voice, but I'm of the personal opinion that if, air quotes, we behave ourselves and these meetings are productive.
Oh my God, Aaron, that's a big, big if.
I did put air quotes. I said, I think that there is the possibility that these conversations can be seen as productive and necessary by USCIS, which means that we might be able to expand the scope of these conversations. And I'm hoping for that. But with only one meeting under the belt, it's really tough to predict.
Well, I can let you into a little secret within the industry right now, Aaron.
Okay.
Not that we all don't know.
Well, you know you're on a podcast, right? I mean, if you say this.
I've told her that once or twice.
You're not whispering in my ear, but go ahead.
But USCIS is in total disarray right now. They're trying very hard. They're struggling because, I mean, we get it. EB-5 is a very difficult area. They lost a lot of staff. They brought new staff on. The new staff are not able to catch up as smoothly as someone who's been in the industry. They're still very, very slow. Investors are frustrated, and there are lawsuits going on left, right, and center. Within the lawsuits, information is coming out. Judges are getting frustrated. It's just becoming a total chaos, or it will descend into total chaos unless something is done. What we can see right now is that if they don't change a policy of communication, and a lot of these cases can be resolved with just some communication, a lot of time, effort, and money can be saved. And at the end of the day, quite frankly, all of this is destroying our industry. It's destroying the projects, feelings about going into something, and investors are getting frustrated, and they're like, we're waiting so long. It's just... Go on, right?
Yeah. No, it's something that has to be done now. And I understand, and it's great that USCIS has come and said, look, we can have quarterly meetings, and we're discussing X, Y, and Z, and we're hoping this expands, but we need it now. I mean, the frustrations are happening now.
Yeah.
We've seen immigration in USCIS in the past, but this is even more frustrating because, like you said, unfortunately, COVID happened. They lost all their staff. They're trying to get back to where they are, but we need to have something in place now because at the end of the day, investors are so frustrated that they're wanting to withdraw from projects. And then where does that leave the project at the end of the day? These are projects that are putting in and wanting to expand their communities, looking for economic growth, looking for job creation. And what are they going to do if all of a sudden investors are coming back and say, I want my money? Then we're going into litigation. Then they're spending more money on that.
Yeah.
It's frustration all around.
And we're getting sort of little snippets of things here and there. For example, in one of the litigation cases, we were told that it was the USCIS's attorney complaining that her internal team were giving her just a few days and not notifying her about mandamus, et cetera. And it just points to mass internal disorganization. And the worst is that this is an agency that imposes such a high burden on us to meet deadlines and establish eligibility at the time of filing, et cetera, et cetera. Aaron, what can IIUSA do for us and the industry?
Well, first of all, I want to paint a little bit of a different picture. You know, Churchill spoke of democracy, and he said it's the absolute worst way to govern a nation, except for all of the other ways. And I think that there can be a corollary here. You know, the EB-5 visa and the regional center program are de facto a huge success. It is a very successful program. And I have had the opportunity to now be in overseas markets and witness for myself the demand in new markets and existing markets, new markets meaning places like Nigeria, existing markets, meaning places like India, where demand for an EB-5 visa is through the roof. And the investors are sophisticated. You know, they understand that there are issues in processing. They definitely understand the price tag of $800,000 is a heck of a lot more than what it might cost them to move their family to Portugal. However, the demand continues to increase and stabilize.
That's very true. That's very true. I will second that.
Because the EB-5 program, what it represents is by far and away the best opportunity in the world for people in investment migration. Hands down. I mean, the United States is by far the best product to be selling. And I'm not waving the flag. I'm telling you the way it is. So back to my Churchill, you know, analogy, I mean, we do have issues, and managing this program the way it's being managed is probably the worst way that we can do it, except for all the other ways that we might be able to concoct. That's not to say that we can't improve or that we shouldn't continue to strive to improve. It's simply to say that I don't think it's all doom and gloom, and I think that there's a lot to be hopeful for and to be thankful for with regards to how this program is running. I think as well, that the communications with CIS will continue to improve too.
You know, I'm not going to say anything about Pollyanna, and I love this program.
No, I'll do it.
And I love this program, and I do second you on everything about it being the most popular place. A lot to do with the economies, and you just have to look about what's going on in Europe right now and other countries and see where we are in the world. And I get it. I totally understand where you're coming from. We are not seeing that. What we are seeing, and again, we see things from very different angles because we see things more on the ground. We are seeing call it a post-COVID trend, just generally within the industry, of not having the staff. But unfortunately, not having right, correct staff is frustrating the program in its practical sense. Let me ask you, Aaron, IIUSA, you look after your members. What about people who are not members of IIUSA? You know, regional centers who decided they just didn't want to join. Do you ignore them altogether if they have a query or an issue?
No, we actually don't. I don't think that doing that is in the best interest of the members. Mm-hmm. You know, all what's the saying about all boats rise, you know, rising tide.
Rising tide lifts all boats. Yeah. We're all in this together is essentially what you're saying, right?
Yes.
Yeah. We certainly do better with more members. But if a non-member has a question or a concern, you know, we recognize that we represent the industry and we're going to do our best to address that. But
well, the reason I ask that is because what we see at this point in order to further anything, and you've been super successful at this, is we think that advocacy and lobbying is the way forward.
For sure. Well, there's no doubt about it. It might be the only path forward that has to continue. You know, IIUSA, you know, the ink was not dry on the RIA when I pulled the team together and I asked, okay, what's next? You know, we cannot rest on this for too long. It takes years to generate a successful lobbying campaign, and we've basically got 4.5, and the clock is ticking. What is it that we're going to do? And thankfully, you know, we've coalesced around some pretty laudable goals, not the least of which is going to be a permanent authorization, nor is the, you know, seeking of additional visas. And I think those are the two really big priorities for the program. You know, more visa, protect the visas that are there, find a way to increase the number of visas for the program, and make this program permanent once and for all. And we've started to develop strategies to do that.
I have to say, the other day when I went to vote, which was yesterday, oh my goodness, time, where does time go? When I was filling the ballot, of course, I'm in New York. I was like, okay, Chuck, you get my vote again because you were so good for with the EB-5. And I didn't realize I said that out aloud. And I actually heard a couple of people around me chuckling away. But we've got some great politicians out there, you know, as part of the team. I think, again, thanks to IIUSA.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, without a doubt. And I mean, we're not stopping there. I'm very proud to say, I'm very proud of the board of directors that recently they voted to establish a political action committee. And I think most people are familiar with political action committees, but if you're not, it is a separate organization organized under the auspice of the Federal Election Commission that allows an organization like ours to make political contributions to campaigns. And, you know, in the United States, for better or worse, candidates campaign year round all the time. And I think that our ability to now provide campaign contributions to candidates that we feel represent and will carry, represent our priorities and will carry the torch on those priorities is a huge tool in our tool bag. Previously, if Mona Shaw wanted to write a check to Chuck Schumer to support his campaign, you could do that. And the Federal Election Commission would look at that and say, Mona Shaw supports Chuck Schumer. And Chuck Schumer would say, Mona Shaw supports me. Now, IIUSA as an organization, or our PAC as an organization, will be able to do the same thing. And instead of it saying Mona Shaw, and Chuck Schumer believes in the principles that Mona Shaw has, now Chuck Schumer will look at the FEC reports, as will the rest of the world, as will all of his colleagues, and they will see that Chuck Schumer accepted a contribution from IIUSA. he must support the ideas that IIUSA is carrying forward. And that record of contribution and acceptance of same is a huge political paradigm shift for IIUSA and what we're trying to put forward, because it's out there for everybody to see. And, you know, a member of Congress has to be able to defend accepting our contributions. And the best way to do that is to say, yeah, I believe that the program should be permanent. Yes, I believe there should be more visas for the EB-5 program. And so overall, the development of the PAC is a huge political tool. And I'm very glad that, you know, that we now have it in our tool bag.
Yeah, I can't express enough how important this is all across the board. But if we do actually advocate something, Aaron, how does that affect, you know, USCIS? Aren't they supposed to be independent? Are they allowed to listen to a Democratic or a Republican senator?
Well, I mean, absolutely, they should listen to Congress. I mean, we do have separation of powers. But if you want to get into the nitty gritty of things, you know, we're likely looking at some oversight hearings in this coming Congress. That is to say, USCIS, immigration in general, obviously, probably the EB-5 program as well. And those oversight hearings are designed to evaluate the success or failure or necessary improvements to a particular program, USCIS. Once the oversight hearing has concluded and the members of Congress, in this case, the Judiciary Committee in the House or Senate, have made their determinations, those determinations can then be turned over to the Appropriations Committee. And the Appropriations Committee reads those determinations and builds into their legislation whether a program like USCIS gets more money to do what it needs to do, or it gets less money than what it needs to do. And that's the interface between Congress and the administration. Congress has the purse strings. And if we're able to make the case, for example, in an oversight hearing, that USCIS needs to do X, Y, and Z, Congress has the ability to tug on those purse strings to make sure that those program improvements happen. And that's one of the things that, you know, that we hope to be able to do. Beyond that, you're right, Mona, that PACs do not impact the administration. That's not how political action committees work. So IIUSA's work to impact the administration will continue to be through the quarterly meetings that we're having, stipulated by the settlement agreement, and the committees that we have to bubble those issues up into those meetings. And then our additional persistence and tenacity as well. And USCIS might be that monolith of a rock, but IIUSA is the water. And we're going to continue to wash over it and wash over it and wear it down until we do have the opportunities to see the results that we need. I hope that's a good analogy.
Well, I think we Rebecca and I can't applaud this enough, and we do try to get involved in everything. But in the meantime, Aaron, these are wonderful and lofty aspirations, and I hope it will happen in the near future. In the meantime, what can a project do if they are facing frustration through, say, you know, a lack of an understanding from USCIS? Do you have any short-term solutions?
Yoga? Not sure. Zen breathing efforts? I'll tell you, I mean, we know what the alternative is. The alternative is litigation, right? The alternative is to file a lawsuit. It is a double-edged sword. You know, those lawsuits are double-edged swords because they become a necessary tool to get done what has to happen. At the same time, it hardens USCIS for continued communications because it feels that no matter what it does, it's going to get sued. And I've had this conversation with members of IUSA before, and it's a real conundrum. And maybe other than yoga, I don't really have an immediate solution, because lawsuits need to be filed. Lawsuits need to be filed because USCIS continues to commit errors. Well, having the conversations to address those errors becomes harder and harder because USCIS lawyers are saying, don't say anything because they're going to sue us. And so the lawsuits beget, you know, lack of communication. The lack of communication begets lawsuits, and around and around and around we go. So
yeah,
it'll take time.
I can tell you, Aaron, as well, you're going to hear a lot more about this from Rebecca and myself, but this whole going to the AAO is very frustrating, and we are advocating, and we're looking to IIUSA to advocate for us for an expedited AAO for EB-5 petitions.
Yeah. Okay. We made that effort in the development of the RIA. We went back to table several times to make the argument that you're talking about right now to obviate, you know, the backlog that AAO has created, and that, you know, we should be able to go directly to court, or at least directly to court after a certain number of days, instead of allowing cases to languish at AAO. And we were rejected out of hand, not once, not twice, but 3-4 times. So as a matter of policy, we are saddled with this reality, and it will take another bite at the apple for us to be able to address it.
Yeah, I think the overall issue is that when it comes to the projects, and you know, if there's issues with the projects and these denials, there needs to be something that, like we said, if you know, Commerce comes in, whatever, whoever it is, and people who have the experience with projects and businesses, I feel like that's what we need so that people can understand.
Yeah.
You know, look, immigration's a separate issue.
Yeah, spot on,
you know,
Rebecca.
Adjudicators can look at the applications and they could get all that in. But what about the project?
I have an idea. And I'm going to share it with you guys for it's we're going to put I'm going to put it out in the world on your podcast first. People will say, I heard it.
Here we go. Hot take.
Ready?
Yep.
I'm serious. I know this is pie in the sky, but I'm serious because it speaks to exactly what Rebecca is talking about. I think that the notion of an EB-5 visa is ridiculous. We are not talking about an employment-based visa. Employment-based visas are H-1B. Employment-based visas speak to the nature of a singular immigrant coming to the United States for the purposes of a job. We're not talking about that. What we're talking about is an investment-based visa. And my idea is that we create a category
Yes, that's what I was hoping to say. Yes. You're brilliant genius.
Oh,
And as long as we're monkeying around with the immigration system, I think that there should be, I mean, we already have the SEC playing a role in all of this because we're talking about investments that are securities.
Yeah.
Obviously, the Department of Homeland Security has a role to play in all of this because we're talking about immigration and security of our borders. I mean, as long as we have more than one organization, federal organization at play here, if we're talking about investment-based visas, I believe that the Department of Homeland Security has absolutely no role or place to evaluate, for example, the nature of a business plan or the credibility of a capital stack in the development of an economic development project. Instead, the Department of Commerce should have that role.
Exactly. That's what we have been arguing that for years. And you know, there's a couple of congressional supporters out there who are backing this. He's Congressman McCall, for one. Mm-hmm. He really appreciates this idea. So does Ron Estes, and they're both Republicans. If we can get it on both sides of the House, I think it would be a superb idea. Genius.
Yes.
Do we have a genius award, Mark?
Bing, bing, bing. There we go. So moving EB-5 out of immigration, not just calling it employment-based, but calling it immigration-based, it sounds radical, but we did something similar about 2 decades ago when we took the U.S. Coast Guard out of the Department of Defense and made it part of the Homeland Security. So as organizations change and develop, and as we realize where things should go for proper placement and best efficiency, I think it makes sense. I mean, that's why we have the Constitution and the amendment process, so it can evolve over time, and maybe immigration and EB-5 need to do the same. Aaron, thank you so much for coming on EB-5 Investment Voice.
That was my pleasure. Investment-based visas.
Well said.
Thank you for being with us today on EB-5 Investment Voice. The topics presented in this podcast is informational in nature and is not to be taken as specific legal advice. If you have questions on the topics presented in this episode or other investment immigration needs, please contact Mona Shaw and Associates. Mona and her attorney staff can be reached at mshawlaw.com. That's mshawlaw.com. Make sure you don't miss our next episode focusing on a different aspect of the EB-5 program by subscribing to the podcast. While you're at it, leave us a rating on iTunes. If you really found this episode valuable, share it with someone else that could benefit from this information. Until then, I'll see you on the next episode of EB5 Investment Voice.